Welcome back to A Country First Conversation. Today we'll be talking about how disinformation is destroying our society. Joining us on today's episode is Chris Krebs, former director of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Chris served at CISA from 2018 to 2020, leading the agency through some tough times. From helping to secure our critical infrastructure during the COVID-19 pandemic to fighting disinformation on the 2020 election. Remember to visit our Country First website and follow our social media accounts to stay informed. Thanks again for joining. Here's our host, Adam Kinzinger.
Well, Chris's professional work is focused on cybersecurity and risk management issues, both in the public and private sector. Chris joined DHS in March 2017, and in 2018, he became the first director of CISA. In 2020, as CISA's director, Chris Krebs was the administration's most senior cybersecurity official responsible for securing the presidential election. And in November of 2020, then-President Trump fired Chris via Twitter due to his commitment to debunking election-related disinformation, much of which was being promoted by Trump and his allies. So with that, Chris Krebs, everybody. And honestly, Chris, we're really excited to have you on today. Thanks for joining. Now, just a quick primer. So my wife, I think I told you this, she worked for DHS. And actually, before, you know, you became a household name, which I'm sure you never set out to do, she always talked about how great CISA was doing and how, you know, of all the DHS agencies, you guys, you really had your stuff together. And particularly given, you know, the fact that you had to basically stand that up very quickly. And during your career, you witnessed firsthand the power of disinformation and how that's used to paint an alternative reality to the American people, to spread fear, to gain political power by foreign and domestic actors. So before we dive in on disinformation, can you explain what CISA is, what it does, and why it was created? And hello, by the way.
Thank you, Congressman. Quite an intro. I appreciate the opportunity to be here and chat with you and hopefully share a few thoughts with the listeners. Podcasts are one of the key ways that, frankly, through my time at CISA and before, it's a great way to pick up different viewpoints in really snappy, concise formats. But it's interesting how, you know, different viewpoints can help shape policy perspectives. And there are a whole raft of cybersecurity and disinformation focused podcasts that I've listened to. So I'm happy to have another one to add to the list here with Country First.
Nice. Nice.
So CISA is the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, and it was established in 2018, as you mentioned. In fact, it was established on November 16th, 2018, and 2 years and 1 day later, I was fired. So that little stretch of a few days in November will always be, poignant for me. But nonetheless, it's an operational agency within the Department of Homeland Security, and I have some thoughts about whether it should stay in the Department of Homeland Security. We can talk about that later. But it's an agency like FEMA, like TSA, like the Secret Service, like the Coast Guard. It is an operational entity. Prior to 2018, it was a headquarters component, meaning it was kind of hanging off the Department of the Department Secretary's office, and had a name known as the National Protection and Programs Directorate, which really doesn't tell you much of anything. And so when I came in 2018, recognizing that Congress had effectively determined that CISA was the lead civilian cybersecurity component in the federal government, I had a name that didn't really make it easy for us to recruit, to go engage with stakeholders. It was hard to maintain morale across the organization. So job one for me when I came in 17 was to get this thing renamed and stood up as an agency. And it took us a little over a year to do it, but it made an immediate impact in just recognition and even recruiting, just being able to go to recruiting fairs and throw it up there. But ultimately, the mission set of CISA is, it's not just cybersecurity. You got to focus on that second piece of the name too, infrastructure security. So it's more about the nation's critical infrastructure. And that's sometimes a term that's hollow or doesn't really tell you what it is either. But it's everything from, you know, our bridges to our banks, our sewers to our schools, airports to zoos, and everything in between. And I have used that line before, and it is cheesy, but it does give you a sense of just how massive our critical infrastructure community here is in the U.S. And again, what CISA's job is to do is work with those private sector organizations, those state and local organizations, and serve as a risk advisor to help them be more effective given the dynamic threat landscape out there, from criminal actors like ransomware crews or from state intelligence agencies like the Chinese or the Russians or the Iranians, or, you know, it go on and go on and I could go on. But again, it's provide them advice, security assistance, technical assistance, support, and just help understand where the bad things that can happen in the nation's economy and our critical infrastructure, and help the partners that are involved somewhere in that space, help them manage their risk.
So you're kind of like, you're kind of going back and forth, right? Between, I guess, government, you have private sector, you're getting information, you're sharing information, you're helping to kind of manage basically what the government's seeing on the broad side, what private sector's seeing, and in essence, making sure that, you know, we're cool, we're good to go, right? Is that probably a good way to put it?
Yeah. I mean, so given the authorities of the agency, that's something I haven't touched on yet here, but the agency's authorities are not compulsory. You know, there's not a whole bunch of regulatory enforcement that CISA is going to be doing out there. Instead, it's really based on public-private partnerships, which is another one of those really terrible bureaucratic beltway terms that doesn't tell you a whole lot about what it is. But, you know, CISA in effect is like, it's almost like a private sector organization where it's a business and you have to have something of value. You have to go out there and hit the road and convince people that what you're selling, or in this case, what you're offering for free to partners is going to help them. It's going to deliver some kind of value. So while there are a whole bunch of really super talented technical folks in CISA, it's also one of those parts of the government where you see a lot of public engagement, almost salesy type work. But again, that's to help tell the story of an agency that has to use the carrot side of the incentives package rather than the stick side that law enforcement or regulators may have to use.
Yeah, it was interesting because I was in on some of this early conversation and when we were talking about this in Congress, and some of our more exotic friends in Congress that are, you know, now pushing the stop the steal kind of stuff, they were all basically, you know, talking about any base government involvement with the private sector, that's, you know, anti-constitutional, whatever. You're just sitting there looking at it going, all right, so are you saying that you'd rather have, you know, a serious attack on critical infrastructure? You'd rather have an election stolen, et cetera. So that was always interesting to see it on that side. And then, of course, you know, the good work you guys end up doing, you know, was huge. And I think, look, if there's an upside to, you know, you having been fired on Twitter for telling the truth, it's that now people kind of understand the role that is. Let me ask you, what's it like to be fired on Twitter, by the way? What was
that was weird. At like 7:09 p.m. on Tuesday, November 17th. I had just walked into the house. As things go, it was a not as late day in the office. Getting home at 7 o'clock Tuesday was pretty early, particularly in the elections space. But I got home, walked into the kitchen, and I got five kids, and so they're all like, you know, running around, and I get a text from someone from a coworker. They're like, you just got fired on Twitter. And I was like, no, you must be confused. You must have confused me with someone else. And then I pop up Twitter and I'm like, oh, there it is.
Just got fired on Twitter.
Yeah. And I was like, I just look at my wife and I go, I just got fired on Twitter. And she kind of looks at me and blinks. And then I look at the kids, and then all of a sudden they start tearing around the house screaming, daddy got fired, daddy got fired.
And she's probably like, great.
Oh no. I mean, it was for her, and I'm sure she was like, God, finally, think. And let's just be clear here. Right. I mean, I had a great job in the private sector that I gave up, and it was a really nice work-life balance. very low key under the radar gig at Microsoft to go into a very politically charged environment. I, you know, told her that I was only going to go in for 12 months, 18 months at the top, you know, max. And, you know, here I am 3.5 years later, and we had had a conversation, you know, at about that 18 month mark where I just said, I was like, look, I know I promised 18 months, but I just, here's what's on the line right now.
Yeah.
And she, you know, she went along, and I'll always be so incredibly grateful for my wife's support, my direct family support, just being there for us, taking care of the kids, you know, when I'm on the road all the time. It just shows you know, some of us are just lucky to have a support network like that and have supportive families. But at the, you know, there comes a time where, you know, enough's enough. And, you know, yeah. I think she was really looking forward to, you know, whatever was next. And if, even if it came, you know, sooner than expected, the transition was fairly abrupt, but it was something that, you know, was going to have to happen at one point anyway.
Yeah. So, okay. So when we talk about cybersecurity and disinformation, is there a link between that? And how would you explain kind of a link between cybersecurity and disinformation? How do they relate and how do they feed off each other?
So I think there are kind of three ways to look at this problem, but you know, ultimately the way that Americans, or maybe it's the Western, you know, liberal democracies, look at these things distinct and differently, where cybersecurity is a technical problem and disinformation is more of a propaganda or psychological operations problem. And so you typically have different solutions, different defenses. The problem is, our adversaries, the Russians in particular, see these things as just tools in a broader toolkit. And they've been very effective, not just for the last 4 or 5 years, when I think most Americans have become, you know, sensitized to the word disinformation. But, you know, think about the way that the Russians, the Soviets, and then the Russian Empire before, this has always been one of their key tools, even beyond just normal intelligence operations. If you think about the Chronicles of the Elders of Zion, that is the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. That was a disinformation operation run by the imperial government in Russia in the turn of the century, 1900s. And it still sticks around to this day. So it just shows you that, you know, as Goebbels said in the 1940s, associated with the Nazis, you know, you tell a lie big enough, you know, enough times or often enough, they're going to ultimately believe yeah. you. And so that, you know, the protocols stick around. In fact, you know, there was a report a few months ago about one of the Capitol police officers had a copy
That's
of
right.
the protocols at his station, you know, in the house that you go work every day.
Yeah.
And so just to step back again, you know, cybersecurity is fundamentally a technical problem. It's the security of the program. It's the users. It's the technologies, it's the processes. Disinformation is about information and trust and, you know, manipulating information to get the outcomes you want. So again, we take it separately here. We tend to prefer to deal with hard technical problems because fundamentally they're easier than having to address these softer things that touch on in particular, the First Amendment and just the sensitivity of speech. And so as we were looking at the problem set in the run-up to the 2020 election, the cybersecurity piece was really, frankly, quite simple and straightforward, and that was working with state and local partners that run elections, get them as much money as we could help them get so that they could improve the security of their systems, bring on cybersecurity experts, replace legacy, out-of-date systems with more modern systems, including voting machines that had paper records, develop post-election audits, like what you actually saw happen in Arizona and Georgia and Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin, rather than this garbage that's happening with the fraud out in Maricopa County. But again, it was about resilience of the process, where technology was not a single point of failure. But part of this is why we knew immediately when these claims of whether it was the Kraken or Hammer and Scorecard or Chavez from the grave in Venezuela coming back to change votes. We knew that it was all garbage because in Georgia, for instance, there was a paper ballot associated with every vote cast. And you could count those ballots 1,000 times over. And with good process and protocol, you'd have the same outcome. And that were, you know, even if somebody had hacked a system, given the paper records, given the security controls and the software independence that you had, the you could have confidence in the outcome. Yeah. So again, the easy part was the technical cybersecurity part. The harder part, though, was the disinformation. And we knew all along that there would be a set of actors out there. Notionally, we pegged our planning scenarios to foreign actors like Russia, but we also assumed since 16 really kind of threw the playbook out that China, Iran, and others could get involved. But we had to plan against what are the most disruptive actions they could claim, not necessarily achieve, but claim that would undermine confidence in the process. And so we had dozens of scenarios built out, and we had a factual information that could be put into place to explain why the things that were being claimed would not ultimately have an impact on the outcome of an election. And, as soon as the caller was inside the house, as soon as we figured that out, ultimately we could just pivot around and say, look, these claims are nonsensical, technically incoherent, and here's why. And don't just believe us, believe the National Association of State Legislatures, believe the National Association of State Election Directors or the National Association of Secretaries of State, believe this federal law, believe this DOJ guidance, believe boop, 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 boop. So we had third party, authoritative resources to point to that, we felt was the most appropriate way to engage on disinformation. And just the last thing I'll mention here is that the way that we ultimately viewed disinformation was trying to break it down to its component pieces. And it was a balance of supply side and demand side disinfo. So you have some that are able to disrupt the flow of disinfo, and that includes the social media platforms, that includes the traditional media platforms that get leaked documents and they get to make editorial calls on whether they report on it or not. And it also involves the intelligence community and the law enforcement community that can understand what particularly state actor or state supported disinformation actors are doing and can identify accounts and things like that. But there's a whole other side of demand, just the willingness of people to accept and absorb as local news is dissolved, as lack of trust in experts and authority figures has declined. What we sought to do was help build up more public resilience and inoculate the public almost from disinformation. And we had a couple of really interesting techniques and campaigns around that. But that's in part what we were trying to achieve with rumor control, which is what we launched last fall about, putting information out there to debunk and in some cases pre-bunk disinfo as it came out.
Yeah. The interesting part is if you think about, one of the concerns I have is just the desire of people to have bad information as a way, even if they know it's fake or they don't even want to bother to look into it, to use that information as a confirmation bias that they were right, mm-hmm. they were correct. Now it's like, okay, look, whatever it is, the CIA attacked DOD or DOD attacked the CIA in Germany.
For the
that was an operation, and yeah, it's true. No, it's
they
not
got
true.
The server.
They got the server,
right.
And then people forget. The problem is when you buy into a conspiracy, then people all of a sudden forget that they ever believed it, or they move on to the next one. But I want to ask, you played a big role, obviously, in debunking disinfo during the election, but you guys were debunking disinformation during COVID. And this is what a lot of people don't understand, is how much of that was foreign driven during COVID. Remember the like everybody got the text. I got it from probably 80 people, maybe because I'm in the government, but you know, I have a friend that works at DHS that told me that there's going to be a national lockdown and et cetera within 24 hours. And it created all this fear and panic. And I think part of that's the reason you had the rush on the supermarkets and all that kind of stuff. But we've seen that that's a tactic used by Russia and China to attempt to create chaos and spread fear and destabilize society. Can you talk about that and maybe your efforts even during the pandemic?
Yeah. So first off, from a, you know, a state actor perspective, when you talk about Russia and we talk about China, they ultimately have different strategic objectives. So specific to Russia, what they're trying to do is paint us as generally, you know, incompetent, to undermine our citizens' confidence in leadership. And part of it is to send a message back home and say, like, look, things aren't that bad here. Democracy is pretty screwed up. You know, we're better off than they are.
Yeah.
But COVID specifically, there were a couple of different activities that were tied back to, you know, a few different state actors. And some were just due to conspiracy theorists, and some were due to anti-vaxxers. And, you know, we can go on and on. I mean, there were a few different themes. One was that 5G towers spread the coronavirus. And that was, you know, that started in a, I want to say it was in, I got to go back and look at the details, but it was a social media, small scale social media community in Europe that then jumped into an online journal that then was reported on local news that then jumped back into a larger scale Facebook, I think, or other social media platform. And it kind of took off from there. And you know, when you look at how operations work, I mentioned earlier some of the campaigns we ran at CISA. One of them that we released in the summer of 2019 was called The War on Pineapple. And the idea here was to take a foreign influence disinformation operation and break it down to its component pieces and educate the American public on how these things work. So ideally, they can spot them as they're happening and not get wrapped up. But the first step is you just identify the issue that you want to either manufacture or that you want to take over and amplify, because that's one of the key things, is that most of these disinfluence or disinfo operators, they don't necessarily manufacture the content. They amplify little nuggets. That's one of the really difficult things, is there's always like little grains of truth, but they amplify or make it of an outsized importance.
Well, and they create a, you know, a site that looks, for instance, like CNN or something like that. And then everybody can retweet that too.
Yeah.
And so now all of a sudden, instead of saying, gee, who is National File? You're like, oh, this looks legit. And so there you go. It's believable.
Yeah. So first, you know, you identify the issue that you want to amplify. Second is you start getting the mechanisms of amplification in place. And, you know, in 16, a lot of that was Facebook accounts or Twitter accounts. I mean, I remember still seeing that one that was like the Tennessee GOP account that they'd put on Twitter and just be like, man, that is really aggressive stuff. I can't believe a state level party. Now, of course, you know, look at what was aggressive in 16 and look at what's happening again with some of the state GOP related accounts in Arizona, some of the stuff they were tweeting out, you know. Particularly around January 6th, and maybe it's not so crazy after all, or it's still crazy. It's just more mainstream. So identify the issue. You know, you start getting in place the mechanisms of amplification. The third is you start the amplification. You get it into the community. The fourth is you take it mainstream, and mainstream is, you know, TV. Get it on news. Get talking heads that have followings talking about it. And that fourth step where it really starts to get bigger not just in sitting in Facebook chat rooms, but it's onto the TV and across cable. That's where things start to get really, that's where the impact starts happening and the spread happens.
Yeah.
And then fifth and finally, or at least so we thought fifth and finally at the time, was get it to go real world. And real world is where you've activated and you've convinced someone enough to radicalize and activate them to go out into the real world and protest, engage, do violence. And, you know, historically, the do violence piece, or at least over the last several years prior to January, well, prior to the election, really, maybe even prior to last summer, was protests and counter protests. And what we saw were in the 2016 timeframe, we saw the Russians support and amplify and push for activation on both sides of a protest and a counter protest. And one was a Black Lives Matter protest. And what they want is they want that division. They want to find that issue that's so divisive that they know that there are people passionate about either side, rightly or wrongly, and they want them to things to come to a head. And so some of this is what we saw from foreign actors here last year, but also domestically, we saw domestic actors use the same techniques. We saw them put disinfo on mainstream, get their followers radicalized and activated, and we saw them say, hey, come out on January 6th. It's going to be wild. And so that was step five. January 6th was entirely predictable based on the behaviors, the language, the steps followed, and more on pineapple that led to the insurrection. Now, what we did not account for, because we hadn't seen it yet, was the sixth step, or as I've called it now, the sixth step, was the codification of disinfo from going mainstream into the real world. Now it's codified. So you look at some of the laws that are being passed in state legislatures across the country,
right,
that are based on the disinfo, that are fed by the disinfo. And now it's become, it's part of this new alternate reality that it seems a significant number of people are bought into.
Yeah, it's incredible. You know, like with these state laws and state, you know, a lot of the times it gets blown out of proportion what's actually being done. But the thing that offends me about it is it's basically being done, all these kind of state election laws, under the guise of, you know, wink, wink, nod, nod. We won't say it, but the election was stolen and we want to make sure it doesn't happen again. And so that's always, that to me is always something where I'm like, huh, okay, that's interesting. But, you know, it's interesting too. So you'd mentioned the domestic side of things. And when we look at QAnon, it was, I don't know, a year, I'd say kind of at the beginning of 2020, when I really started to know who QAnon was. Just I'd heard some of the theories and obviously the ludicrous. I think back to Jade Helm in 2015, mm-hmm. where the government Texas. Was going to overthrow Texas. And even the Texas governor activated the state guard. It's not the National Guard. It's like a volunteer, like Civil Air Patrol, I guess, of the guard. But he activated the guard, quote unquote, to monitor the federal government's activities. And that's just the chicken way out versus explaining to people that, you know, Jade Helm is actually just a federal exercise and it's not an overthrow of the government. But that's the, and then by saying, gee, I'm going to have the state guard go watch, you're solidifying that disinformation in people's minds. But when I looked at kind of the rise of QAnon and you realize these things exist in a whole dark world that I'm not watching and people are believing it and it's growing. And frankly, in the lockdowns and the pandemic, it gives people 500 bajillion times more time to look at the internet and get sucked down rabbit holes. What do you see as, how did some of that lead to ultimately almost an attempt, or it was an attempt, but an almost successful attempt to overthrow the government on January 6th?
So kind of the pathology of QAnon is not that different from, as I see it, what's happening right now with some of the local politics that we're seeing play out again, like Arizona. So, you know, all politics is local. The most effective disinfo similarly is local. When you look at what's happening in these various states, and I'll come back around to the point here on QAnon, what is happening in many of these states is that either the state party chairs or the leadership in the houses, the state houses, are seeking to kind of quell dissent in the base, quell the you know, address the fears that the election stole. So like, I tell you what, why don't you know, you from this district over here, just, you know, whatever legislation you want to put up, if you presenting that, you know, and offering it up for consideration makes your, you know, your constituents happy and addresses the their concerns, whatever they are, then let's just keep moving that. The problem is, once you get that in motion, it's really hard to stop. The same thing goes with QAnon. QAnon, once it got in motion, people would kind of like, oh, it's just some crazy people. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Then it catches on, becomes right. Mainstream. And the opportunities for intervention were much earlier. But somewhere down the line, we lost some collective courage here to speak truth, to actually say, hey, this is right. There's nothing behind this, whether it's on election disinformation or just conspiracy theories in general, that there's, you know, a pedophilic blood drinking cabal that's running the world. It in some cases, that specifically, it's like, it's so crazy. Like, how could you even, you know, how could you even address it publicly and give it some degree of credence and effectively, you know, give it the liar's dividend, where they get, you know, a legitimate purpose, a person acknowledging its existence, and therefore, you know, giving it a couple, you know, cred points. That, you know, that's where we struggle, I think, with dismantling disinformation and conspiracy theories, because, you know, you don't want to give it, and you don't want to give it credibility, but you also are like, you don't want to, you know, roll around with pigs and come up a little bit dirty or a lot bit dirty. So yep. You know, we've got to figure out a better playbook here for engagement and in action.
Well, I remember I did a video on QAnon early. It was really when people had just started even recognizing it. And I'm like basically calling this stuff out, whatever. And I had a number of colleagues that said, hey, saw your video. It was good. But why are you giving it attention? And I said, look, I think I'm already too late. Like, I think this thing has grown so big, and that's what brings the difference now with, you know, having social media. If everybody was watching three news networks a night, I think then there is some sense to saying we don't need to address conspiracy theories, because the only place people are getting that is word of mouth, you know, like the old mid-90s UN black helicopter stuff. But instead now, it's got a whole separate world of its own. And if you don't address it early enough, and you know, this time it was also especially unique because you had a man that was president of the United States, that the best thing you can say is he at least didn't debunk these conspiracy theories. But I also think in many ways fed these conspiracy theories, particularly QAnon, and particularly, you know, the idea of Proud Boys with this stand back and stand by and all these kind of winks and nods and go, oh, QAnon people, I know they love America. Well, no, they don't. If you're pushing QAnon stuff, you don't love America. You know, you are trying to tell people that America is a lie. So, you know, that was the unique thing, is you had a man in such authority. And I think that's why people were so scared to come out and say something different. And so that brings me to another question, or kind of the thing to wrap up I want to ask you about, which is, you know, you obviously were outspoken with the lies and disinformation, despite your, you know, boss and a few layers up going out and saying the election was stolen. You easily could have been quiet. You easily could have said, well, I'm just going to keep my head down, like frankly 99% of my colleagues in Congress do. But you were one of the most senior officials, you know, for securing the election, and you spoke out and you had the courage to speak out. So why did you do that? What was it about? What was going on that where you said, look, you never set out to be a public figure, but I'm going to set out and tell the truth?
So, I mean, I've gotten this question a bunch and give some variation of an answer. I mean, I'm not sure I've ever given one that I'm entirely satisfied or comfortable with. And yeah. I think part of this is just, you know, it's the obvious answer, because it's like, well, because I guess my parents raised me right. I don't know. Right. I mean, it's like, yeah. I've got a sense of, you know, what's wrong, and that what was happening was lying to the American people. And, you know, I like to think that I hate when, you know, some of these words have gotten, co-opted, patriotism and all, yeah, you know, patriots and all that. It's like, because, so don't say, I was like, cause I'm a patriot. No, like, I believe in that America's can be a good place, yeah, and that we can do great things, that we have done great things. We've done bad things too, but you know, this is one of the best opportunities for, you know, a diverse multicultural country in the history of the world. And, you know, anything I can do to help contribute to that and keep this thing moving forward, I was going to do it. And so when it came down to ultimately an attack on an attack on the very process by which we determine who leads this country, I pledge an oath to the Constitution, like you did when you were sworn into office and when you were in the service. And I tended to take that pretty seriously. You know, I will uphold and defend the Constitution against all enemies, both foreign and domestic. And it was a pretty clear decision for me. I also, you know, like I said, I got 5 kids. I want to be able to, look them in the eye every day and tell them that I'm, you know, I'm doing things right. And they, you know, they can be proud of me. So again, see, I tell you, I give crappy answers to this every time, but
I feel the same way when I'm asked. I mean, it's like, what do you say?
Well, right. I mean, I feel like you've done more than I ever did. I mean, these things are, it's just, but you know, what do you do when you're in the moment? Are you going to do the right thing? Are you going to cave? And, you know, to me, it was never about the job. It wasn't about, am I going to stay as CISA director? Greatest job I'll ever have, probably. But to me, it was about the things you do in the job rather than the, you know, actually having the job. And I think that's in part what differentiated me, is some people wanted to stay in their jobs long, you know, more than they wanted to do the right thing. And you know, I took my, you know, I did what I did. You know, I'll you know, say that we did, you know, try to stay out of the spotlight, as much as possible, up until we just couldn't do it anymore. We were trying to be supportive to our partners in our agency and the state and local government community and the private sector. But support to them at some point turned into them looking at us and saying, we need you to help us more. And, you know, you're the national authority, anything you can do to help us. And so it wasn't an opportunity that was always there, but when the opportunity was there, we made our assessment, we made our statement, and, you know, then you get fired on Twitter.
You know, the interesting thing, I think anybody that goes into public service, doesn't matter if you're left, right, you know, if you're even probably Matt Gaetz, even, you know, goes into public service thinking, I'm going to do the right thing, I'm going to make a difference, and I have a red line. I have a red line that I won't cross, and a red line that, you know, to me, my integrity and truthfulness is, you know, far surpasses any fame you can get, any like affirmation. And for me, what's been so disappointing, Chris, is, and probably for you too, people you knew, see people that you thought, you know, if it came down to going to battle, whether it was literally battle or, you know, figurative battle, they would have my back, they would be there. And to see then the fear in these people. And I think in the case of Congress, and I think in really any government service, it's that people get their identity from the job. And unless you're willing, particularly in this kind of time, in this moment, unless you're willing to lose that job and to lose that identity, you know, if you haven't found your identity in something else, it becomes almost a impossible choice to do the right thing. Because, you know, let's say I'm a 70-year-old member of Congress. It's the best job of my life. People know who I am. They never knew who I was before. And if I stand up and tell the truth, I'm going to lose this job and I'm going to lose that identity. And I think you see, you know, frankly, what happens when people get their identity from a flawed man, and a flawed man convinces them that if you speak out and say something against me, I'm going to tear that away. And it's sad to see so many people that have fallen to that.
I mean, I got to say, that's probably one of the best descriptions I've heard of particularly the kind of the co-opting of the political class. It is really, you know, either that or they're just like fundamentally, you know, sociopaths and right. they've just been covering that up you know, out of shame or something. But yeah, and that's what's just to me so deeply, yeah, I mean, disappointing is not even the right word. It's just like scary that, yeah. that, and the thing that kind of, can I cuss on this or?
Yeah.
Nah, I'll keep it, you know, at least in the
PG. We'll bleep it. It's okay.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing what pisses me off right now about the dialogue and, you know, like, oh, you know, disinformation, we've become so polarized. I was like, don't make this a political issue. This right. is not a political issue. This is not Republicans and Democrats at its foundation. This is about a departure from democracy and a rise of autocracy and how yes. an autocratic movement has co-opted a political party, or at least yep. part of it, and unfortunately a big part of it. That's what we're talking about here. We're not talking about Republicans and Democrats. We're talking about, you know, a rise of, or at least a preference towards now authoritarianism. And so don't, you know, that's the conversation that needs to happen right now. And why the hell we're walking away from the democratic ideals that we, you know, we all thought we believed in.
It feels like sometimes if you're a country and a people that have everything like the United States does, you have to find a reason to screw that up. And I tell to all those out there lusting for a civil war and, you know, these, they're all like kind of usually older men who have, you know, 8 different heart medicines they're on. Like, by the way, Walgreens is not going to stay open during your civil war, nor the supply yeah. chains. And, you know, if you had a hard time wearing a mask during COVID, trust me, you're going to be miserable when the federal government collapses and you're scrounging for food. It doesn't matter how much you have hidden in the basement, how many ARs you have. There's always somebody with an AR that's a little better than you. And so it's not something to lust for. And so, Chris, let me just say in closing, you know, I've gotten to know you since this. I personally appreciate you and what you're doing out there saying, but I dug up a quote you had in the Washington Post, and you said, "I'm not going to be intimidated by these threats from telling the truth to the American people," referring to the threats by the Trump campaign. You had the courage to speak out early on. You inspired a lot of us. You were willing to tell the truth, regardless of what it cost you. And we commend you for that. And Country First really believes in putting our country over party. And we admire your courage to do so. So we want to say thank you. And I appreciate your service and integrity.
Thanks, Adam. And I got to say, you know, I've already mentioned at least once here, but, you know, what you're doing, what Congressman Cheney and a few others are doing, Gonzalez is important. It's a reminder that there are decent Republicans still out there. So keep it up, and hopefully we'll keep chipping away at some of those that are, you know, whether it's the fear factor or maybe we just need one former guy to just, you know, disappear from the, yeah. the public and political landscape, and they can get, you know, some of their self-determination back. But thanks for what you've done. Thanks for being there for the country. Keep it up.
You bet. Thanks. And thanks everyone for joining us, and we'll have a new one soon. Thanks a lot, Chris. Take care.
This has been a Country First Conversation with Adam Kinzinger and former CISA Director Chris Krebs. The Country First team wants to hear from you. Please be sure to share in the comments or send us a note at info@countryfirst.com to share your thoughts. And be sure to visit countryfirst.com for our other podcast conversations. And be sure to subscribe to receive all the latest updates. Thank you for joining, and we'll see you next time as we put country over party.